reason. But if you come to me, if you love me, everything will be all right again."
Mary raised her revolver, aimed carefully at his forehead, and shot. The recoil jarred her. She had known it was coming, but it still took her by surprise, and almost knocked her back against the doorframe. Adam howled and fell to his knees. Blood ran down his face, from his temple and into one eye. He wiped it with the heel of his hand, presenting an even more horrifying visage than before, with blood smeared over one cheek. He glared at her and said,
"Who the devil are you, girl?"
"I'm Mary Jekyll," she said. "Stop, or I'll shoot again." He threw back his head and laughed.
"Jekyll's daughter? Oh, that's rich. Do you hear that, Hyde? Jekyll's daughter with a toy gun in her hand."
The laugh turned into a howl, and the wolf men howled with him. The boar man shook the bars of the cage. Mary raised her revolver and aimed at him again.
"No!"
It was Renfield, standing by the cage of the beast men.
"He promised me lives, many lives, as many as I wanted if I would be good. And I was good, master. I said that I killed those girls. I said everything you told me, and I want my lives now."
He turned toward the cage.
"What is he doing?" asked Watson.
That corner of the room was dim, too far away from the lantern, and the lamp on the desk did not cast its light so far.
"He has a key," Catherine shouted.
She'd been able to see what the rest of them could not, but the result was evident to them all. In a moment the door of the cage opened with a metallic clang, and the beast men were out, all but the one in the corner. The wolf men were coming directly at them. They were men, but they were still wolves. They came with mouths open, teeth sharp and tongues hanging out, slavering. Mary braced herself for a second shot. But Watson shot first. One of the wolf men fell, whimpering, to the floor. The second leaped at Watson and sank his fangs into the doctor's shoulder. Watson screamed. The sound shocked Mary. Holmes stood between her and the second wolf man, his revolver still trained on Adam, who was shouting with pain. Mary ducked under Holmes's arm. The room was a chaos of noise and movement, and her arm ached from the first shot she had fired. But she shot again, aiming at what she could, which was the wolf man's side. He gave a bark, stumbled, then fell. Watson staggered back against the wall and slid down until he was sitting, his knees drawn up. Mary crawled over to him. The shoulder of his jacket was torn and hung down, but worse than that, the flesh beneath it was torn as well. Blood dripped down the sleeve. She was almost afraid to touch it, but she must do something.
What?
"Tell me what to do, doctor," she said. He looked so pale that she was afraid he was going to faint. She felt a pull on the hem of her skirt and looked down. It was the wolf man. Not dead, but clearly dying. He looked at her with the eyes of a wolf, pleading. He did not understand death any more than an animal does. He raised his head and howled. For a moment she pitied him. But Watson would bleed to death if they didn't get him out of there, soon. That was what she must focus on right now. Mary heard a sound behind her. More beast men? Surely there could not be more. She turned. There, standing in the doorway behind them, were Diana and Beatrice. Thank you, she thought. Not sure whom she was thanking. God, or Diana, or both.
Do you think you can defeat me? Me? Adam Frankenstein?
Mary turned back to see Adam stagger forward, blood running down his face, once again moving toward Justine.
You can kill these pitiful creations of Prendix. You can kill them all, but you'll still have to contend with me. And you, Justine, understand that you were made to be mine. You are mine forever. I would rather kill you with my own hands than see you live without me.
Come any closer and I'll tear your throat out.
It was Catherine. She stood in front of Justine in her nightgown, with Watson's jacket hanging open, and screeched with rage. It was a wild sound, the sound of a puma in the mountains, inhuman and frightening. Beatrice.
It was indeed. I'd never heard anything like it.
Beasts! Bring her to me!
Adam shouted. The boar man lunged at Catherine, while the bear man turned and lumbered toward Holmes, reaching for him with misshapen hands. Once again Holmes shot. He hit the bear man in the forehead, and with an almost puzzled expression, the bear man stumbled forward and fell at the detective's feet. Catherine leaped at the boar man, gripping him with her hands and feet as though she were still a puma holding on to her prey. She bit down on his ear. He roared with pain, plunging left and right, trying to shake her off. She held on tightly, but he grabbed her by one leg and threw her onto the floor. The boar man leaned over her and opened his mouth, aiming for her throat, trying to bite through it. She twisted and turned in his grasp, feeling his hot breath on her skin, smelling the stink of it. And then she saw two hands reaching above her, grasping the boar man's face, the thumbs over his eyes. She looked up and saw Beatrice, beautiful and grim. The boar man howled with pain. He stood and tried to shake Beatrice off as he had shaken Catherine, but now he was blind. His flailing arms found her and encircled her as though in an embrace. He held on as tightly as he could, squeezing her around the chest. Beatrice struggled and gasped for air.
"Help me," she called faintly.
Dodging around Catherine, still lying on the ground, Diana tried to find an opening, an opportunity. She waited for the right moment, waited, waited. Then she plunged her knife into the boar man's back. Beatrice.
How did you know the knife would not plunge into my back? We were circling round and round that beast and I, as though we were dancing a waltz.
Diana.
I didn't. In life you sometimes have to take risks.
Beatrice.
Thank you, I think. At least you didn't stab me. I suppose that is what matters.
The boar man roared and let Beatrice go, but the knife was too small to do much damage. He swung around, then turned toward Diana, following her smell. He lumbered in her direction, swinging his arms wildly. She backed away, but she was no longer near the door. In her effort to find an opening, Diana had circled around, and she was now backing into the corner. In a moment she would be trapped. Suddenly, light glinted against the boar man's throat. He fell to his knees and then forward onto the floor. Behind him stood Hyde with the scalpel in his hand.
You must be Diana, he said.
Hello, Dad, said Diana. Nice to meet you, I guess.
Traitor, roared Adam. Who took you in after you left England? When you were wandering around Europe, friendless, wanted by the police, who gave you shelter and safety? A laboratory so you could continue your experiments. It was I, and this is how you repay me. You're mad, Adam, said Hyde.
The boar man moaned once, then lay dead at Diana's feet, the blood from his jugular draining onto the floor.
You told me we were coming to England, so you could challenge the society that had expelled me and would not admit you as a member. Remember that? You wanted to punish Van Helsing and his faction. When you recruited Prendick and we started making beast men, I believed you. And then we started collecting the women. What for? More experiments, you said. When I told you Justine was alive, it became all about kidnapping her, bringing her to you. This was always about your personal desires. You disgust me. How dare you? You rat! You ape! You piece of refuse that I took in! How dare you insult me!
Adam turned to the cage, now empty except for one remaining beast man, the one in the shadows.
Come out! He said. Come out now!
He strode over to the cage and picked up what was hanging on the wall beside it, a long black whip. He swung it, hitting the bars so they clanged and rattled. The last beast man started toward the cage door. Mary, who was still kneeling by Watson, attempting to staunch the flow of blood from his shoulder, cried out. An old poem, taught to her as a child by her nursemaid, who had later become the respectable Mrs. Poole, went through her head. Tiger, tiger, burning bright. The tiger man had started to undergo the process of transformation, but was still only half man, half tiger. His head was vaguely human, his paws beginning to resemble hands. He walked awkwardly on all fours, with no tail. The scars from a series of surgeries gleamed red and angry. He growled low in his throat at Adam, but seeing the whip, he turned toward Holmes and crouched, ready to spring. Holmes raised his revolver. Suddenly the room was silent, except for a low sobbing that Mary realized was coming from Renfield, still crouched in the corner by the cage with the keys in his hand. Would a bullet stop the tiger man before he could crush the detective in his jaws? Catherine stepped in front of Holmes. Would she spring at the tiger man? Surely that would mean her death. She was less than half his size, no match for the power of his animal body. Mary was about to cry, "Stop!" when Catherine shrugged off Watson's jacket, then pulled her nightgown over her head, and stood naked in front of them all. "Look at me," she said. The tiger man crouched, still ready to spring but not moving, looking at her. Over her brown skin ran the seams of many scars, like the map to an unknown destination. "Smell me. I'm like you, brother. I too was transformed by a master with a whip. But do you know what I did, brother? For all the pain I had endured, I killed him. That was what I did. I turned on him and bit him through the throat. He was not a god, only a man, and he died more easily than I thought possible. Do you understand me, brother?" The tiger man looked at her with great yellow eyes. Then he dipped his head, still barred with black stripes, almost as though nodding to her. With a roar, he turned and sprang on Adam. Mary realized she had stopped breathing only when she started again. She'd been so afraid the tiger man would attack Catherine. "Catherine, I wasn't afraid. He was my brother. And if he had attacked me, it would have been a fitting way to die." Diana.
"Oh, come off it. You always say stuff like that, as though you were in one of your own novels."
Catherine. "Well, at any rate, I would have died so quickly that I wouldn't have felt it. What else was I supposed to do? I acted out of instinct. If I'd thought about it for a moment, we might all be dead now." The tiger man landed with his paws on Adam's chest. Adam staggered back against the desk but did not fall. The tiger man lunged for his face, but Adam hit him in the jaw with a fist, once, twice. With a roar, the tiger man fell to one side, landing heavily. He staggered and shook his head, disoriented. Where the paws had been on Adam's chest, his shirt was torn and streaked with red.
"Renfield, the keys!" shouted Adam.
"And you'll give me lives? Many lives, master?"
"Yes, as many as you want. Just throw me the keys, damn you!"
Renfield tossed the keys into the air. They arced, silver in the lamplight, then jangled as Adam caught them. He stepped behind the desk and pushed the chair aside.
"Watch out!" shouted Brendick. "There's a gun in that drawer! We kept it locked because of the beast men!"
The tiger man shook himself once more, then put his front paws on the desk and jumped up so he was standing on top of the desk, between them and Adam. The desk was covered with piles of paper, probably receipts and bills of lading for Alderney shipping. The piles slid, and pieces of paper fluttered as the tiger man moved among them. He snarled and swatted Adam across the face. Adam's head snapped back, and long red welts appeared along his cheek. The tiger man reared back to strike again.
"Diana, give me your knife," said Mary. "Why?" said Diana, not taking her eyes off the dangerous dance at the end of the room.
because I need to cut bandages, and then you need to get Justine out of here.
What? Why me?
Because the rest of us have weapons and you don't, said Mary.
For goodness sake, just do as you're told for once.
Lead Justine to the rendezvous place.
What rendezvous place?
Across the street, that alley where we all met. Just take her there.
Oh, all right. I never get to be in on the fun.
How is Watson doing?
Asked Holmes, looking down for a moment.
Not well, she replied. We need to get him out of here as soon as possible.
She cut strips of cotton from her petticoat and wound them around his shoulder as best she could. But the bites were fierce and deep. If they did not get him out of the warehouse soon, Watson would bleed to death. Adams snarled back, as though he were an animal as well, and hit the Tiger Man once more across the face. The Tiger Man fell heavily, sending papers fluttering across the desk and to the floor. In the moment that gave him, Adam had unlocked the drawer and taken out a revolver. It shone, cold and metallic, in his hand. Holmes aimed, but once again the Tiger Man had risen and was between them. He roared, and then there came another roar. Adam had fired the revolver directly into his mouth. The Tiger Man fell back onto the floor in a shower of papers. As he fell, his paws reached for a final purchase. One of them caught the lamp, which toppled and rolled over the desk.
"Oh, no, you don't!" shouted Adam to Diana. "You're not taking her anywhere!"
Mary glanced back for a moment. Thank goodness. She could see Justine disappearing through the office door. How would Adam respond? He was still standing behind the desk, revolver raised. There were papers on the desk, papers on the floor, and now...
"They're burning!" shouted Catherine.
Oil spilled from the lamp and spread across the desk. Suddenly the desktop was in flames. Adam stepped back and raised his hands as though to ward them off.
"We must get out of here," said Beatrice. "The chemicals in those jars are flammable."
"Out now, all of you," said Holmes. "Mary, can you support Watson?"
"With help," she said. "It will have to be Catherine. He's too weak to breathe Beatrice's poison."
"I'll help," said Hyde.
Mary looked at him, startled. Why was he offering to help? No doubt so they would let him escape.
"You're not as strong as I am," said Catherine contemptuously.
She put her shoulder under Watson's arm. Mary put her shoulder under the other, and together they raised him. Holmes still stood with his revolver trained on Adam, who was almost invisible behind the flames on the desk and the smoke rising from them. The papers on the floor had caught fire as well. Renfield was screaming, a high shriek like a tea kettle on the boil. Something bolted out from under the operating table, the orangutan man. He ran toward Holmes. More quickly than the detective could respond, the orangutan man reverted to his animal nature, and on all fours, slipped between Holmes and the doorframe, then out the door.
"He's not important," said Holmes. "But you need to go. I'll stay and see this through to the end."
They filed out through the space behind Holmes. Beatrice first, then Mary and Catherine supporting Watson between them. Hyde tried to follow them, but...
"I don't think so," said Holmes. "You're not leaving until I do."
As they left the room, Mary glanced back. Holmes raised his revolver and shot at the lantern hanging from the ceiling. The reservoir shattered, and oil spilled over the floor. In a moment, it too was in flames. Then she saw Adam in flames, lurching from behind the desk across the room. How many bullets did Holmes have left? She had not kept count. But she could not stay to help him. There was Watson to get out into the cool night air. She and Catherine followed Beatrice down the hall, stumbling out the door. They crossed the street, with Watson's feet dragging on the stones between them. In the alley, Diana was waiting, with Justine and Charlie, and...
"Alice!" she cried. "What in the world are you doing here?"
Together, she and Catherine set Watson down as gently as they could against the brick wall of a warehouse. He was moaning and barely conscious.
"She's from the Magdalen Society," said Catherine.
"How do you know her?"
"She used to be my scullery maid, as how," said Mary. "Alice, what were you doing?"
"Look," said Beatrice.
Through the first floor window, they could see that the warehouse office was filled with flames. And in a moment they could see flames through the window on the second floor as well. Flames rose to the roof of the warehouse. Where was Holmes? Mary scanned the building anxiously.
"Don't forget, we have a wounded man," Beatrice reminded her.
"Of course. He would be all right. He must be all right. Sherlock Holmes would not be defeated by Adam Frankenstein.
Would he?"
"No, certainly not," she told herself.
She turned to Charlie.
"Can you find some way to get Dr. Watson to a hospital? He needs to be looked at immediately. A cab or a cart of some sort."
Mary checked the bandages on his shoulder. They were already stained through.
"Oh, look, miss," said Charlie, "though cabs don't come to this part of the city, and I don't know where I'm going to find a cart this time of night."
"I'll go with you," said Diana. "It's better than waiting around here."
Before Mary could stop her, she followed Charlie into the darkness.
"Damn that girl. Will she ever learn to do as she's told?"
Mary tried to make Watson as comfortable as she could on the cobblestones. He moaned again and shook his head back and forth. It reminded her of the wounded tiger man. Had Holmes come out of the warehouse yet? Resolutely, she brought her mind back to the problem at hand.
"Someone is on fire," said Justine. "Look, through the window. Is that him? Is that Adam?"
In the warehouse office lurched a form, massive, entirely engulfed in flames. The flames were so high and bright now, blazing through the windows and up from the roof, that they illuminated even the alley.
"It must be," said Catherine. "Who else would be that tall?"
Two shots rang out. Who had fired them? And then Holmes was running out of the building with Hyde at his heels. Mary breathed a sigh of relief on seeing Holmes. But Hyde? For a moment she wished he could have died in the fire. The thought was wrong, unworthy of her. This was her father. No, she was not ready to accept that. Not yet. When they reached the alley, Hyde looked back at the burning warehouse.
"I don't suppose even Frankenstein's creature can escape such a conflagration," he said. "Wait, what are you doing?"
Holmes had clapped a pair of handcuffs on him.
"Edward Hyde, you are under arrest for the murder of Sir Danvers Carew. It will give me great pleasure to deliver you to Scotland Yard."
Hyde snarled like a dog, then threw back his head and laughed.
"Nicely played, Mr. Holmes. It will be my great pleasure to see you prove your case in court.
And I will be sorry when you are hanged, Mr. Hyde."
"Wait, where's Prendick?" asked Catherine. "Did he get out? Is he still in there?"
Mary.
"I was worried you were going to run back in after him."
Catherine. "Certainly not. I mean, I did think about it for a moment, because unlike him, I don't leave people to die."
"I have no idea," said Holmes. "In the confusion of the fire, he could have run toward the back of the building and escaped out the window."
"Prendick always was a coward," said Hyde. "A coward and a mediocre scientist who lacked imagination. It was foolish of Moreau to teach him as much as he did."
"That's probably the only thing on which we will ever agree," said Catherine.
"Isn't that him?"
asked Beatrice.
A dark shape was running across the road toward them.
"Don't leave me! I don't want to die! I don't want to die!"
Renfield waved his hands frantically.
"All right, you won't die," said Holmes. "Just come with us, quietly, mind, and we'll take you safely home again."
"To my flies?"
asked Renfield, rubbing his hands together.
"Yes, to your flies," said Mary. "Big, fat, juicy ones.
You just need to come with us.
Since I am inconveniently out of handcuffs, added Holmes.
Oh, I'll go with you so nicely. I'll be good. You'll see.
Renfield smiled anxiously. He can't be trusted, Mary thought. And yet they would have to trust him for now. Certainly he was more deeply involved in this case, with the Société des Alchimistes, if not the murders, than they had thought. How had her father, or rather Hyde, convinced him to confess to murders he had not committed? And why Renfield in the first place? What was his connection with the Society, and with Hyde? But this was no time for questions. With a crash, the roof of the warehouse fell in. They could see burning pieces of it falling into the second floor, where Beatrice had been held captive. The street was no longer dark. Now light from the fire flickered across the cobblestones, illuminating the London night. Even in the alley they could feel its heat and hear its roar, as though it were speaking with the voice of the dead beast men.
"We need to move," said Holmes, "both for Watson's sake and because I need to let the authorities know there's a fire. It could spread through this entire area."
"We found it!"
Diana's voice came out of the darkness. She emerged, followed by Charlie, into the light of the conflagration.
"There's a steamboat by the docks and the captain is willing to take us upriver. He swore at us proper for waking him up and said he wouldn't take us for love or money. But I told him you had lots of money, so I hope you do. He says he won't fire up the boiler until he sees it."
"He can take us to the Royal Hospital. Surely they'll have the facilities to treat even such a wound," said Mary. "If only they could get Watson to a hospital quickly."
"Dr. Watson will not live that long. Not if he loses more blood," said Beatrice. "We must cauterize the wound."
"How?" asked Catherine.
"There's our fire to heat metal, but it's too dangerous to approach. You can feel how hot it's burning, even from here."
As she spoke, the second floor broke through and fell into the first. By the time the fire burned out, the building would be a skeleton.
"I can do it,"
Beatrice rolled back her sleeves.
"Mary, remove those bandages. They must be changed anyway. They are soaked through with blood."
"A chemical burn. How clever of you, Miss Rappaccini," said Hyde.
Beatrice looked at him scornfully.
"You would have made me a murderer," she said.
Mary had not realized she could sound so contemptuous.
"Mary, and I've never heard you sound like that since."
Diana.
"Oh, no. Our Beatrice is always so polite."
Mary. "Unlike some."
Mary removed the bandages as quickly as she could, trying not to think about how deep those gashes must be, what all that blood meant. When the shoulder was bare, although crusted with blood, Beatrice touched it, carefully, carefully, with the tips of her fingers. Where she touched, the dried blood bubbled away and the skin burned, but it was clean, as though disinfected by fire. With more strips from her petticoat, Mary bandaged the shoulder again.
"Nicely done. You would make a good nurse, Miss Jekyll," said Holmes.
Mary flushed at the compliment, glad it was dark so Holmes could not see.
"Now, I must get Watson to the hospital. Charlie, can you find the nearest fire station and alert the fire brigade?"
"Of course we can," said Diana. "If you turn left and left again, there's a road down to the docks. The boat is named Hesperus. It's painted on the side."
"No, you stay right here,"
said Mary, but it was already too late. Charlie and Diana had melted away into the darkness.
Damn and double damn.
"Well, Miss Prim and Proper is cursing," said Catherine. "That I never thought I would hear."
"You're going to hear it a lot more if she keeps behaving like that," said Mary.
Diana.
"And I have. You know, it would do you good to curse a little more."
Mary. "Don't you have something productive to do? Like, I don't know, drink poison?"
"I'll lift Watson if someone can help me on the other side,"
said Holmes.
That will not be necessary, said Justine. I am recovered from the ether now. I can carry him myself. What a strange procession they made.
Catherine walked in front, since she was the only one who could see in the dark, wearing Holmes's frock coat over her nakedness. The moon shone brightly onto the street down to the water, but the warehouses in this area were old, the streets badly maintained. It was easy to trip over uneven stones or bits of refuse. Behind Catherine, Justine carried Watson as easily as she would carry a large pillow. Behind her walked Holmes with Hyde at his side in handcuffs, and Beatrice next to him. He had been warned that if he tried to escape, either Catherine would bite him or Beatrice would breathe on him. He did not seem to relish either option. Then came Mary with Alice, and finally Renfield in the rear, afraid to be left behind in the darkness. Chapter 17. A Boat on the Thames. Even in the darkness, Mary could see that Alice had her arms wrapped around herself. She took off her mackintosh and draped it over the girl's shoulders. There, put your arms into the sleeves and button up the front. It's too cold for a nightgown. However did you end up at the Magdalen Society? I thought you were going back to your family in the country somewhere. I don't think you ever told us.
Will you be angry, miss, if I tell you that I lied to you and Mrs. Poole? There weren't no family in the country, just a charity school. My mum left me at an orphanage when I was only a baby, because she couldn't take care of me herself. When I was old enough to learn my letters, I was sent to the school for impoverished children in Spitalfields. I've never been outside London. But you told me about milking cows and gathering eggs.
It was difficult to believe that Alice, shy, silent Alice, had lied, particularly to Mrs. Poole. Why, Mary herself wouldn't have been brave enough to lie to the housekeeper. Mrs. Poole. She knows I've forgiven her. Alice is a good girl and won't do it again. Alice.
Thank you, Mrs. Poole. Aye, one of the other girls was from the country, said Alice. At the school there were two kinds, girls whose parents paid for them, though little enough it was, and girls who had no parents and who were paid for by subscription. That was me, one of the charity girls. My friend was one of the paid girls. Her dad paid for her because her mother had died and her stepmother didn't like her. We shared a bed, and at night when I couldn't sleep, she used to tell me stories about life on the farm. She was terrible homesick. But why did you lie to us?
They were at the water now. Moonlight shone down on the Thames, and at the dock, among the boats moored there, was the Hesperus. Its lanterns were lit, fore and aft, and Mary could see its name written in white paint on the prow. It was a small steam launch, with its chimney already smoking. The captain must have decided to trust them after all.
Ahoy there, called Holmes. May we board, captain?
Aye, if you'll show me you can afford it, shouted a rough voice.
The captain stepped into the lantern light. He was what Mary would have expected a steamboat captain to look like, grizzled, with a knit sweater and flat cap on his head.
£1 for each person, that's what I want. And if I can count correctly, and I can, there are 9 of you, and that makes £9 even.
£9?
Said Mary. That was an outrageous sum.
Aye, that's what I want, little lady. And it looks to me as though you'll pay it, seeing as that gentleman ain't looking too healthy. What did he do, drink too much? And what are you, circus performers? Not that I care, mind you. It takes all sorts to make a world, and there are sorts down here by the docks that would make you think the world was a strange place indeed.
I'll give you 5 now and the rest when we get to the Royal Hospital, said Holmes. This man is wounded. We must get him to a doctor as soon as possible. I give you my word that you shall be paid.
Aye, and who might you be?
leading a man around in handcuffs, followed by loose women in various states of undress. How am I to know you're not a criminal yourself?
Loose women? Well, looking around her, Mary had to admit they didn't look particularly respectable. At least Alice had a Macintosh to cover her nightgown. But Catherine's bare legs stuck out from under Holmes's frock coat.
I'm Sherlock Holmes, and I'm taking this man to Scotland Yard.
Mr. Holmes, am I supposed to believe that? Then you'll be able to tell me all sorts of things about myself without me having to tell you.
The captain looked skeptical.
Tell me something, Mr. Holmes. Anything about me that you wouldn't know.
Holmes's expressions were usually difficult to read, but even by lantern light, Mary could see that he was thoroughly exasperated.
Your initials are GM. You smoke a pipe. Your preferred tobacco is Old Virginian. Indeed, you were smoking your pipe as we approached. You were a sailor, but were wounded by a bullet to the shoulder, so you gave up the seafaring life to become a riverboat captain. Your wife is a conscientious woman who scolds you for drinking excessively. Is that enough to prove my identity, Captain? My associate, Dr. Watson, is grievously wounded.
The captain looked at him with wonder.
It's like magic, it is. Aye, I'm George Mudge, and you're right about everything. Even the old woman, who's far too good for a reprobate like me. How we do like reading those stories of Dr. Watson's on a Sunday evening. It will be an honour to take the both of you and your companions upriver. Come aboard, Mr. Holmes. I'll have to tell Mike, who runs the boiler. He won't believe it's really you.
If Mary had not been so tired, she might have laughed out loud. Next, Captain Mudge would be asking Holmes for his autograph. What a night it had been. Fear and tragedy and absurdity all mingled. She simply didn't know how to respond any more. The steamboat was small, just large enough for about 20 passengers. Under ordinary circumstances, it was probably a pleasure launch, hired for day trips up the river. Justine carried Watson to the back where he could lie on one of the benches. Holmes followed her, leading Hyde. Beatrice went after him, and Mary was about to follow as well, but...
No, I want to go up front, said Catherine. It's bad enough being on the water. At least let me breathe fresh air, not that stuff coming out of the chimney.
I didn't know you disliked water, said Mary.
Did you ever know a cat that liked it?
Catherine led them to the front of the boat, past the chimney. Mary did not particularly mind the smoke, but to Catherine, with her cat's nose, the stench must be terrible.
Catherine, it was. Most of London smells terrible. Except the rubbish heap outside Billingsgate Market. That smells of lovely fish heads.
So Mary followed her, relieved that she did not have to sit near Hyde. Eventually she would have to confront him, but not yet. Alice followed Mary. There they settled themselves on the seats facing forward, presumably so pleasure seekers could see where they were going. Renfield stood undecided, not certain which way to go, but finally turned to sit with Holmes and Hyde in the back. Thank goodness the madman would not be sitting with them. Yet another thing Mary would not have to worry about, for a while at least. When they were seated, Mudge cast off the line, and then they were free of the shore and on the water, steaming up the Thames in the darkness.
I've never been on a boat before, thought Mary.
Yet another item on the growing list of things she had never done. The wooden seat was hard, the air was cold, and there was darkness all around the lantern on the prow, like a large firefly leading them into the night. All around she heard the lapping of water. The ground under her feet, which had always been so stable, was no longer stable, but swayed side to side, as though she were floating on uncertainty itself.
Beatrice. That's a lovely image, Catherine.
Catherine.
Thank you. I rather like it myself.
I may write cheap popular fiction, as a reviewer recently called it, but I can do symbolism. Catherine, who was sitting next to Mary, touched her arm and leaned toward her. Are you all right? I think so. I'm not sure. Probably not. It's the first time I've had a dead father reappear, you know.
She said it low, so Alice would not hear. The last thing she wanted was Alice worrying about her.
It's going to be all right.
Catherine squeezed her arm. The gesture was unexpected from Catherine. She'd been so aloof, so independent until now.
We're going to be all right.
Adam's dead, the beastmen have been destroyed, and we're going to get Watson to the hospital.
Yes, I know.
Mary wished she could sound more convinced. It was the darkness, the motion of the river, the way it mirrored the uncertainty of her life, of all their lives.
But what about you, Prendick?
Catherine looked out at the darkness.
As soon as you told me he was alive, I knew I would see him again.
She was silent for a moment, then added,
He looks different,
older, and his hair's turned grey. I didn't get the chance to talk to him. Perhaps I never will if he died in that fire. Although if he survived the ocean, he can probably survive anything. But Hyde, I mean, your father, you'll have to speak with him, you know. At the very least, you'll have to ask him about the Société des Alchimistes. You need information, if nothing else.
I'm hungry, said Alice suddenly.
Begging your pardon, miss. Perhaps I shouldn't have mentioned it, but I had the thought, and then it just came out. Must be almost dying back in that warehouse. That would make anyone hungry, I'm sure.
Mary laughed, low so as not to disturb the silence. Not that anyone would have cared, but it was so present, the silence of the boat, the sound of the water, that it seemed almost a sacrilege to speak too loudly. She could not help it. Here she was worrying about what would happen tomorrow and the day after that, when there was plenty to worry about tonight. Thank goodness for Alice. At least her problem had a solution.
I'm sorry, Alice. I don't have anything. Although as soon as we get home, Mrs. Poole... Wait! I do have something after all.
The tea cake she had put into the pocket of her Macintosh earlier. Could it possibly still be there?
Reach into your pocket. No, the other one. Yes. Can you feel something?
Alice pulled out the tea cake, flattened like a top hat at the opera.
Well, it will have to do for now, I'm afraid. At least it didn't fall out along the way.
Alice ate it in small bites, to make it last. They could hear a murmur from the back of the boat. It was Holmes's voice, Mary was sure of it, and then a rougher voice that must be the captain's.
What were they talking about? I'm sorry I lied to you, miss, said Alice. See, the headmistress at the charity school, she weren't a kind woman, or an educated woman neither, like you, Mrs. Poole. She didn't like having charity girls. Only the Board of Trustees made her take them so the school could get subscriptions. She always said no one would want an orphan. So when I was sent to you to see if I would do as a scullery maid, I told Mrs. Poole that I had grown up on a farm. My friend had told me so much about it because she was homesick, that I could talk about milking and gathering eggs and how the hay smelled when it was cut and stacked in the fields. I ain't never seen a hay field, really. I'm sorry, miss. I was only 10 at the time and didn't know better. You don't need to apologize. I'm just glad you're safe and coming home with us. But tell me how you ended up at the Magdalen Society.
And why were you following me? Asked Catherine. That's how she was caught by Hyde. I was in Mrs. Raymond's office looking through her desk when that old witch and Hyde walked in. They started talking about the girls. Mrs. Raymond was the one giving Hyde their names so Adam could kill them and take their body parts. And they heard a noise. Alice was outside the door. Why were you standing outside that door?
Well, it were this way. I hadn't nowhere to go when Miss Mary dismissed me. I tried sweeping a crossing for a while, but a big boy took my crossing and the broom I'd bought. The money Miss Mary had given me for my wages was running out. I slept in doorways, but the police would tell me to move on, so I would be walking most of the night, and soon I wouldn't be able to buy food. So I thought, who can orphans turn to when they can't turn to anyone else? Why, to God, of course, Like it says in those books Mrs. Poole never wants me to read because she says they're so low, but only a penny. So I went into a church, and the minister asked about the state of my soul and whether I was afraid I'd fall into sin if I lived on the streets, and I said yes. Although I'd have thrown myself into the Thames first, which I suppose is another kind of sin. The minister gave me a pamphlet and told me about the Magdalene Society. I was careful to tell Mrs. Raymond that a gentleman had importuned me, thinking she might not let me stay if I just said I was hungry, and she told me to sign that big book. I told that lie to you too, miss, she said to Catherine, and for that I'm right sorry. I didn't know you were a friend of Miss Mary's then. So there I was for a week, getting fed regular and a bed to sleep in, although terribly bored when I saw you.
Diana.
I told you, Our Lady of Dullness and murder. I guess the murdering part wasn't that dull.
Alice.
I'd rather the dullness, thank you very much, having almost been murdered myself. I'll wear scratchy wool, eat overcooked food, and listen to sermons that make you fall asleep in your chair if it means not being poisoned.
Diana.
Alice, you have no sense of adventure.
Alice.
Quite right, miss. You hadn't yet gotten your Magdalene Society dress when I saw you,
Alice continued.
That terrible grey wool was all we had to wear. It was when you were coming out of Mrs. Raymond's office. I was mopping the floor on my hands and knees and got a good look at you as you walked past, though you wouldn't have noticed me then. I thought, I'd know that dress she's wearing anywhere. It belonged to Mrs. Jekyll, God rest her soul. It was her lavender tea gown, and many's the time I've helped Mrs. Purvis, the laundress, wash it. And I thought, I want to find out why she's wearing that dress. So when we went into the sewing room, I watched you, and then at dinner I sat next to you. I asked Sister Margaret if you could share my bed, since I was lonely at night, having always slept with another servant. That was another lie, I'm afraid. And then when you got up at night, I followed.
Well, that explains a great deal, said Catherine. She sounded amused. There was just enough light from the lantern to see that she was smiling. And I have to compliment you on the lying. You seem quite accomplished at it.
Oh, it's terrible, miss, said Alice. But once I get started, I can't seem to stop. Going on about gathering eggs in the morning, how warm they felt in my hand, and the cornflowers in the fields, and my two brothers, about how I missed the farm when I'd never been farther from London than a cab horse. Oh, Alice, if only I'd known, said Mary. I couldn't have paid you, but you would at least have had a roof over your head. I couldn't tell Mrs. Poole, miss, not after the terrible lies I'd told. Well, we're going to go home and tell her, and then you'll stay at Park Terrace until we can figure out what to do with you.
Home, said Catherine. That sounds rather nice. Home. She was not sure she believed in the concept.
It does sound nice, thought Mary. And that was what she'd been assuming, without realizing it. The house on Park Terrace would become a home, for Diana and Beatrice and Catherine and Justine and now for Alice. They would all live there together, no more going off to join the circus or perform in freak shows, which might not at all be what the others were assuming would happen. In the back of the boat, a different conversation was taking place.
Your initials are on your handkerchief, which is tucked into the sleeve of your jacket. The pipe is in your breast pocket. I can see the stem and you smell of tobacco smoke. There is ash on the breast of your jacket, which, together with the distinctive smell, allowed me to identify your preferred tobacco at once as Old Virginian. As you may know, I have written a monograph on the different types of tobacco ash and how to distinguish between them. You have the weathered face of a man who has spent years in a tropical climate and the bearing of a military man, particularly about the neck, so you could have been a soldier. But the knots at the end of your dock lines are distinctly nautical. Even if they were made by your subordinate, you would have taught and supervised him. I deduced a man who had served on a sailing ship, most likely in the South Seas, and had come back to London to settle down. It would be easy and logical for such a man to run a steamboat up and down the Thames. You move your left arm stiffly, likely from an old wound, and there is a bullet on your watch chain, no doubt the very bullet dug out of that shoulder. You have the flushed nose and cheeks of a drinker, and your trousers are patched on one knee. A thick patch, carefully sewn around the edges. There is your conscientious and no doubt thrifty wife. Such a wife would object to your nights at the pub and is not likely to refrain from scolding.
Ah, well, when you explain it like that, it seems obvious, said Mudge.
Of course it always seems obvious once it's been explained.
Holmes sounded annoyed, but Beatrice could tell he was scarcely paying attention to Mudge. He was worried about Watson.
Put your hand on Dr. Watson's forehead, she said to Justine. How does it feel?
Hot. Hotter than it should, I think.
Watson's head was on Justine's lap. She held him as tenderly as though he were a young bird in a nest.
It is the way she holds everything.
When you are as strong as Justine, the world is terribly fragile.
I was afraid it would be, said Beatrice. He's running a fever, Mr. Holmes. If I had my medicines, I could bring down the fever and fight the infection, but I have nothing. I only hope the hospital has what he needs. The state of medical knowledge in London is, let us say, not what one might expect of the largest city in the world.
I'll get you there as quickly as I can, said Mudge. I'll tell Mike to stoke up the boiler, then send him back here to meet you. He won't believe it's you, sir. What a night. We came down here because a party of gentlemen fresh from a club in Mayfair and deep in their cups wanted to go slumming, see what they called the real London. But they were supposed to be back hours ago. No doubt they're dreaming in some opium den, unless they've been murdered already. I was cursing my foolishness in having agreed to bring them down here, but it's allowed me to meet you. Life's a rum thing, ain't it? If I find a piece of paper somewhere, you'll give me your autograph, won't you, Mr. Holmes?
Holmes assured him that yes, he would be perfectly happy to autograph anything, if the captain would just get them to Chelsea as quickly as possible. Mudge went to check on his boiler, and they sat in silence. The detective, the murderer, the giantess, the poisonous girl, and the man who might die that night. In the bow, Mary, Catherine, and Alice had also fallen into silence. What were our heroines thinking as the boat moved upriver through the darkness? Diana.
Now you really do sound like a penny dreadful. Anyway, how could you possibly know what was happening in the back of the boat when you were sitting in the front?
Catherine. Because I asked Beatrice, and unlike you, she has an excellent memory. Beatrice.
Please don't interrupt. I want to know what we were all thinking. I remember what I was thinking.
Beatrice watched the face of the feverish man. Had she done enough to sanitize the wound? If there was fever, infection must be present. Could it be stopped in time? She thought of her father's garden in Italy. The herbs she'd grown there could stop the infection, but where would she find them in England? She remembered the Italian sun and the hills around Padua, with their vineyards, their orchards of fig and olive trees. How different from this city, where it was always cold and wet. Would she ever be warm again? Once she had wanted love and joy, but those were gone. She no longer expected them of life. All she wanted now was freedom. If she had that, it would be enough. Catherine remembered another ship, bearing her away from the island where she had been made, pretending to be an Englishwoman although she had never seen one, guessing how she was supposed to act by what seemed to be expected of her, what the captain and his sailors were startled by in her behaviour. She had learned quickly not to climb the rigging, to eat her food with fork and spoon as well as a knife, to agree that the heat of the sun made her feel faint, and accept a seat in the shade. Anything unusual in her behaviour she explained as loss of memory from the trauma of being shipwrecked and having to sustain herself on a deserted island. and then the long voyage to England as the ward of Sir Geoffrey Tibbet, wearing white cotton dresses he had bought for her in Lima, carrying a parasol to shield herself from the sun. He was half in love with her, but unwilling to admit it to himself. She was not surprised that when he introduced her to his wife, on the doorstep of his house on Curzon Street, the woman had welcomed her with a frown and said, "Do come in," as though meaning the exact opposite. Then, scrounging on the streets of London, like one of the stray cats that lived on refuse, would she have to go back to that life? Or was this a new life waiting for her? A life with these other monsters? For weren't they monsters after all? Mary was thinking of the handcuffed man who sat in the back of the boat. This small, crooked man with the sneering face. Was he truly the tall, respectable Dr. Jekyll? The father who had perched her up on a laboratory chair and shown her the different colours of the Bunsen burner flame in response to various chemicals? He had not acknowledged their relationship except by a careful nod, which could have meant anything but felt significant somehow, as though he were afraid of going too far, of making a gesture that would be rejected. As it would be, she thought, I could forgive him betraying me, but betraying Mama? Never. Diana might accept him as her father, but Mary never would. Justine, if she had been anyone other than Justine, would have been thinking of that day's events, of how she had been kidnapped by the beast men and taken to the creature who had loved her so long with such a cruel, sick love. She would have been thinking of how she had been rescued by Holmes, Watson, and the other women. But she was Justine, so she was thinking about whether or not there was a heavenly resting place where Adam's tortured soul would find peace at last, or oblivion. And she was probably quoting something from Goethe. Justine. I was, in fact. I was thinking about Goethe's idea of the soul. It resembles the sun, which seems to go out at night, but is simply diffusing its light elsewhere and will return when day comes. We cannot see it, but that does not mean it doesn't exist. So, too, with the human soul. Faith is knowing that the soul is eternal, whether we see it or not. As God is. Diana.
Whatever. Can we get back to the story? This is the interesting part.
Far away across the city, Diana was being important, and a boy. She was telling the fire marshal that she and Charlie had seen a fire and thought it should be reported before any more buildings were burned. Diana.
See, you have no problem writing as me when you have to.
Catherine. When I absolutely have to.
You rascals probably set it yourself, said the fire marshal, frowning down at them. I should have you both arrested. What were you doing down by the docks anyway?
Oh, no, sir, said Diana. See, we was following this gentleman, thinking he might give us a few coppers, like. He looked rich enough, and we thought he might be going to one of them dens of iniquity, as me mum calls them, and he wouldn't mind parting with a few coppers. But he went into that warehouse, and there was another gentleman waiting for him, and they started shouting at each other and going at each other something terrible. I'll kill you for that, Prendick, the other man shouted. And then he hit him, and the one named Prendick hit back, and they were circling round and round each other, grappling like wrestlers, and it was a grand fight. But then they fell on top of the lamp and knocked it over, and soon the whole room was on fire, like the picture of hell in the child's own Bible. That's how it started, sir.
And how did you see all this, unless you went in after him?
Why, we watched it through the window. We didn't want to miss such a grand rumble. And then the Prendick one come running out, and the other fellow, he just lay there. And before you could say Jack Robinson, the building was up in flames to the second floor. So we come to tell you, and maybe you'll give us some coppers for being such good citizens, eh?
Nothing for you. I know what you were about, following a gentleman. Planning to pick his pockets, likely as not.
If you'd done so, you'd be going to jail right now. All right. Call out the men, Jensen. There's a fire down by the docks, though precious little we can do about it. Those old warehouses are about falling down anyway. And you two, get yourselves out of here. Someday I'll see you both swinging from